Right, okay, so, yes, as Millie said, we have finished Tohu and Light. Now, and in fact, the level before Tohu, the level before Tohu, before existence at all, which is just the infinite Ein Sof, just the oneness of the infinite. And then we have the process which leads towards creation, which the Lurianic Kabbalah describes as Tzimtzum. And that is the veiling. Moshe Cordovero also talks about it in these terms, in terms of the veiling of the radiance of the infinite oneness, in so that there is a realm in which the world can be created. Because otherwise, there's only the infinite oneness, which is so intense that nothing finite can exist. So we're dealing with the paradox of how something finite can be there in the face of the infinite. And that remains the paradox of our lives all the way through. So the fact is that there is a creation, and we are here in this world, but nonetheless, our very existence remains a paradox. And that paradox we might try to resolve through art and music and other varieties of human expression. And of course, prayer, Torah teaching, all these are ways in which we are responding to a paradox and reaching beyond the paradox to the infinite within, and the infinite within reaches towards us as well. So there we have those two sides of the paradox. There's our situation and our resolution of it, or attempt, our process of resolution, and there is also the infinite process of resolution as well, because we are in an infinite system, and therefore it's not restricted to the idea of a kind of transcendent God who has no time for infinitesimal man. That would be putting a limitation on the concept of the divine. As one of the 16th century Tzfat Kabbalists put it, "Kashem sheyesh lo koach bibligvul," just as he has the power of infinity, "kein yesh lo koach bigvul," so too has he a power in the finite realm, because otherwise, atama chaser mi shlemuto, you are decreasing his wholeness. So in other words, part of the unlimited aspect of the infinite is the ability to somehow be part of and relate to our lives as finite human beings. So, and that every leaf on a tree has some sort of significance in the totality of existence. So that's the process that we're moving towards. And so there we begin with the step before creation, just the infinite oneness. And then we have the moment of Tzimtzum, of veiling, and then there is what is described in the Lurianic Kabbalah, in the books, called Eitz Chaim, the Tree of Life. Partly because it has to do with the story of the Tree of Life in the story in Gan Eden, in the Garden of Eden, and also because the author was called Chaim Vital, and the custom was that you call books after your own name. And very often people are known by their book. So Rabbi Yosef Karo wrote a famous commentary which later on became the Shulchan Aruch. So his commentary is called the Bet Yosef. So he's called the Bet Yosef, the house of Yosef, his name being Yosef. Mm. And so with other famous figures as well. Yaakov Katz, the famous Israeli historian who passed away a few years ago, he said one of his last books was called the Shabbos Goy. And he, and it was all about the historical concept of the non-Jew who comes into the Jewish home on Shabbat, and which is, you know, makes the fire when it's a cold day. So he wrote a historical analysis of this, you know, and the whole idea of exclusion and tolerance and relating with another society and not relating with another society. And he made the comment, "It's lucky that people don't call me by the name of my book." the Shabbos Goy is coming. So that's the. So there we have the idea of the Eitz Chaim, the tree of life, where we then come to a further dimension of teaching called Shvirat HaKelim, the breaking of the vessels. And that is the world of Tohu, and the world of chaos. The world, everything was Tohu Vavohu, the Hebrew text said, and that is an expression of chaos. And this chaos is explained by the Kabbalists, by the Lurianic Kabbalists, as the process of Shvirat HaKelim, where there is an intense radiance which is being revealed, and in order to have existence, you have to have a mediation of two opposites. You have to have radiance, and you have to have Kelim, vessels for the radiance. Because otherwise it's all just radiance and everything is infinite. There are no limits, there are no borders. So you have kelim, vessels. What are the kelim? In Hebrew, hit'avut ha'or, a thickening of the light. That the light itself thickens in some way so as to be able to contain itself. In fact, the divine principle which enables the kelim to exist is higher than the radiance itself. It's a deeper dimension of the divine which will restrict the revelation of the divine. So it's a that itself is something paradoxical but very finely balanced, because if the radiance is too strong for the vessel, then the vessel shatters. And this is the process which was at the beginning of creation. And the rest of creation, which ends up in the world that we're in now, is a process of tikkun, of repair. Now this idea is much beloved by therapists who study this kind of teaching. Because in fact the image for inner destruction as being a product of a radiance which is too intense and the vessel is too fragile, maybe because of trauma or some other issues at some point within the person's life, which gives them a weakening of the power to contain. Yeah. There are intense experiences in life just in the process of living, being with other people. And we need a power to contain. And if that power to contain has been weakened or damaged by some problematic aspect of our history, then it is likely that there would be, or it's possible, that there would be an inner breaking of the vessels, the Shvirat HaKelim. However, that is the beginning of healthy creation. That is the beginning of the world of repair. So it's an extremely optimistic perspective on the process of being a human being, of existence as a person, because destruction is not the end. Destruction is the beginning of rebuilding. Now, if we apply that to Jewish history and to the history of society, it's a very interesting way of looking at things. And so there, these are areas which we have already discussed in more detail in our meetings here. And then last time we met, we spoke about the beginning of this process of repair, which is the revelation of one by one, the 7 days of creation. So the 7 days of creation are not only seven days, in the sense of a day being a garment of the soul. That's one aspect of the day. The day is a garment of the soul, and our soul has many garments, and each garment is a day of our lives. And so what do we put into that day, and how do we live that day, and what were the choices which we either seized or dropped? So that's the garment of the soul, and the garment of the soul is composed of divine names, and the name of God, Yud-Ke-Vav-Ke, the Tetragrammaton, that is the basic divine name, which those four letters have got a number of different combinations. You could have Yud-Ke-Vav-Ke, or you could have Yud-Ke-Ke-Vav, or you could have Vav-Yud-He-He. And how many combinations do four letters have? A, B, C, D. How many different combinations can you put them in?
I don't know, but is it 70 for the divine?
Well, it's what they call in...
Factorial.
4 factorial, that's right. 4 times 3 times 2, which is...
24.
That's right. So that's the 24 hours of the day. Are the 24 combinations of the divine name which are given giving energy each hour, a new permutation of the divine name, which is also rather optimistic teaching, because whatever went wrong the last hour, then you've got a new existence and a new flow of life force.
Sometimes it feels that way.
Well, every moment is a new beginning. It's a wonderful. There are concepts, and then there are ways in which these concepts can be lived as people. And to a certain extent, the classical Kabbalistic texts are basically giving concepts. The way in which you live it as a person is more emphasized in Hasidic thought, where they will take an idea and then show how that is to be implemented. So one is never caught, one is never trapped by the past, because there is always a new beginning which is taking place. And to a great extent, we live our lives as trapped by the past of one kind or another. It's either something someone did to me, or it's something I did to someone else. And both of these things have a force of restriction and of limitation, and to be able to break out of that and be free with that and be able to act in a free way. I think ultimate freedom is what we are really talking about, being able to be a free person, whatever the situation. So that is the this process of tikkun, and the 7 days, the 7 days of creation being days. They're also days with 24 hours, because our day is exactly that. It is something which is special and which is spiritual, which goes back to the very beginning of the process of existence. And together with the fact that it's formed by movements of sun, moon, stars, everything around us is all part of this revelation of infinity. And we're in the middle of that revelation, and we are affecting it in certain ways. We are achieving it, or we are concealing. So we are either revealing or concealing. And sometimes Kvod Hashem Haster Davar, the right thing is to hide something, because that's not the moment to reveal. So one needs to know when to reveal as well and when to hide. And all that is part of this process. And so last week, we talked about let there be light. And light is Midat HaChesed, the attribute of kindness. And it's the quality of giving. You see, in the Kabbalistic diagram, which I forgot to bring with me, but I think all of us are familiar with it, where you have the infinite, and then you have wisdom, understanding. We have Keter, the crown, then wisdom, understanding, knowledge, kindness on the right side, severity, mercy in the middle, victory, and then submission, and then dedication, and then finally kingship, fulfillment, the feminine. So that whole structure. So in that process, what is flowing through the structure? Light. That's what it's termed. It's a metaphor. But it's a metaphor for a kind of divine effluence. It's interesting that there is a word which is used in Kabbalistic and Hasidic texts, Elokut, which I'm giving it a K instead of a He because of respect for the divine name. But if we say Aleph Lamed He, and then a Vav, and then a Taf. This is actually a very modern form of a word, because all these abstract, the feminine nouns like this, with a Vav Taf at the end, are usually abstract nouns for some kind of idea. And it's something that in the modernization of Ivrit, this became a very important process of being able to talk about ideas, not just things, but ideas. And so the fact that the Kabbalists and the Hasidim use this term, Elokut, so there's not just God, there's godliness, the quality of God, and the flow of godliness. What do you mean God flows? Well, godliness flows, and that godliness is radiance, or sometimes it's described as a stream of letters, like Aleph Bet letters, almost teasing us with the fact that you can look at the light as a wave motion, or as particles. The two ways of understanding the transfer of energy, light, heat, as wave or particles. So you've almost got a parallel to that in Kabbalistic thinking, that it's either a flow of light, like a wave motion, or it's a stream of letters, like discrete particles. So a lot of people get very intrigued about the interlocking of Kabbalistic thought and whatever is the latest fashion in theoretical physics or something like that. But theoretical physics does change.
More, yes, it does.
You know, so the way things were spoken about in the 60s are then different in the 80s, and they're different today. So I think if we just look at the Kabbalistic paradigms and ideas and the Hasidic teachings around them, we gain a more enduring way of conceiving existence. And of course, everything else in existence, whether it's art, science, music, literature, it is all going, sociology, it's all going to fit with that in some way, because, or biology, because it's all part of the continuum, which is a divine interaction within the divine, which we see as the creation of the world and existence and our existence and the process of history, exile and redemption. So that's the process which we're in the middle. So last time we talked about light, and now we're going to talk about the next stage, which is the second day of creation. So here we have, by courtesy of some website, I can't remember which, Jewish Bible text, you know, yes, something like that, and the Jewish Bible text very kindly gave me a choice, of which this is one. So we have here the next stage of creation, Vayomer Elokim, and God said. Now the word for God that is used here, Elokim, is a word which in itself, that's the word which is used all the way through the story of creation. Elokim. And
which is judgment, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Elokim is the attribute of judgment or severity. Yudke Vavke, the Tetragrammaton, that is described as the attribute of mercy. Mm. So the fact that the world is created by the attribute Elokim
is very understandable from the point of view that we've been describing, because the process of creation is a concealment of God. It's a self-concealment of God. Otherwise, there would be no visible finite creation. It would all be infinite godliness. So the power of chesed, the power of revelation, is this supreme power of revelation of the inwardness of the divine in some form, and that would just explode the whole process of creation if there was no other force. So in fact, it's Elohim which is the process of creation, and that's why the word ha'olam, so I often repeat this, but I do think that it's a now this word can be pointed ha or lam, right? We can put a comments underneath and a cholam there and a comments there. Ha or lam, and it'll mean the world, the universe. But we can also put different pointing, which is ha alem. Ha'alem, something like that, or maybe with the Chatzim Segel. Ha'alem, it can mean concealment. La'alim, to conceal. So the world is a concealment of the divine, and as a result of that, we have the concealing aspect of the divine is what is creating the world. One of the problems in life is that a person gets depressed because they expect to have a good deal. If we start out with the idea that the cards are being given out by the attribute of severity, we won't be surprised.
That we don't get a good deal.
We won't be surprised. And if we're not surprised, then we can be besimcha. That's whatever the situation. That's... So there we have. Vayom Elokim. Elokim said, "Yehi rakia b'toch ha'mayim." Let there be a firmament. Wonderful words. This is the only time anyone is ever going to meet this word when confronting these verses of the Torah. I don't believe the word firmament has actually reached any other kind of usage in daily English language. You know, there are many words which are quite obscure, but then they get a transferred meaning, whereas firmament is firmament.
That's in English, but not in Hebrew. Hebrew, rakia.
Oh, rakia. Sure. Rakia is a very, a multiple word. Yes, le hoka. The idea of beating out things in art, that's also using the same root. It's quite a multiple thing in Hebrew, whereas, as almost every Hebrew word has many, many uses. Mm. Whereas firmament in English remains solidly, it's only one context. I don't think even Shakespeare managed to find another context to use it in. That's what it is. Or maybe, who knows? Yehi rakia, let there be a firmament betoch ha'mayim, in the midst of the waters. Vihi mavdil, and let it separate bein mayim lamayim. Right? In Sephardi, we don't make any distinction. Ashkenazi, you would say bein mayim lo moyim. Right. So. Now, let's just try and understand the image. Water. See, there's light and there's water. These are powerful images in the book of Genesis. So there is water. Water is basically the continuum of existence. Water itself is very special. I mean, just looking at the word in Hebrew, mem yud mem. The first mem is an open mem, and the third letter is a closed mem. And the, see, given that an aspect, an important aspect of the communication of this kind of spirituality within the world relates to the Sfira Malchut, the attribute kingship, which also represents the feminine. The idea of the two kinds of mem, the mem which is open and the mem which is closed. And there is a verse in Isaiah. Normally the mem which is closed is the mem sofit, that's what we call it, the final mem. The mem at the end of the word. But there is a phrase in Isaiah, l'marbe hamitzcha, where the letter l'marbe is spelled lamed, closed mem, resh behe. So there is a closed mem in the middle of the word. And there is a beautiful series of discourses about a locked garden, representing the Sfira Malchut, the attribute of kingship, feminine, with this idea of a locked garden, which is like the closed mem or the open mem. So we have here a sense literally of mystery and of hiddenness and revelation and these qualities which are there in water, mayim, with the letter Yud in the middle. The Yud being the first letter of the divine name Yud Kei Vav Kei, and itself representing revelation and spirituality. Now, water fits into a certain paradigm when we're talking about the waters of Torah, because Torah is very often described as water. And that is that the water descends from a very exalted level, like on a mountain. If you climb up a hill, let's say, not to get into any too dangerous or cold situation, but we go hill walking and we can climb up to, you know, a relatively pleasant hill where you can see a spring coming out of the ground. Don't have to climb terribly high in order to see such a thing. There's a spring flowing from the ground. And sometimes you can see that there are several such springs and they all eventually join together and they become a river which flows through the valley. So you've got the hills at the top of the valley and then these springs of water coming down and flowing into the river. And that is described as the concept of Torah. The Torah begins at a very exalted level, a very upper, pure level, and then it flows down into such a way that it can become accessible to us as water. Now that's the image of Torah as Mayim in the context, Torah as water in the context of a world that's already been created. Here we're dealing with the very beginning of creation, and it is not Torah which is the water, it's the helos, it's the whole, which is a Greek word which is also adapted by the Kabbalists and Hasidim as the Chomer HaHiyuli, the helitic matter, which is the essence of existence, and which that existence has to have a tzura. It is the matter without form. There's a further dimension whereby it gets a form and it becomes a very specific object. This is an apple, but at a higher level, or a more primal level, it does not have form, it is simply matter. And here we're speaking at an even more primal dimension, where there is simply a continuum of water, this spiritual stroke physical water. Indeed, all existence, the way that we look at it today, is intriguingly spiritual in its being. I remember being told by my chemistry teacher in Form 3, which today they call Year 9, and he said, all the particles in this room would fit into a thimble. <You know? laughs> And there he was. It's true, we're sitting in the middle of an electromagnetic spectrum, and you know, without making too much of this sort of the scientific model, it's intriguing that from the point of view of whatever moment in modern science we're at, there is a great subtlety about the nature of existence. So are we speaking here about physical water? Or are we speaking about spiritual water? And I would say that the answer is yes to both.
To both, yes.
Yes, we're speaking about something physical and spiritual, because physical is spiritual, and spiritual is physical at a certain stage. There comes a point where they are isolated from each other, and our job in creation is to put them back together again. They look isolated, and we have to try and resolve that isolation and bring them back together so that the physical expresses its spiritual quality and the spiritual is expressed in physical, practical terms. So there is a tension in existence where heaven and earth are separate. We're actually looking at the moment of separation between heaven and earth. And we have to somehow pull them together and resolve it. So there we have a continuum of water. Water which has this spiritual, divine quality, and which is both spiritual and physical. And God is now going to divide the water. And there is a force of division which is called Rakia, which is called firmament. And we can call it, we haven't got a very good English word for that. In fact, it's quite a difficult concept to think up in purely physical terms. But it's something which divides the water. And so as a result of the division, we now have a realm above, which is the upper level of spirituality, and we have a realm below, which is the lower level of spirituality. And they are called in the Zohar, Mayim Elyonim, the upper waters, and Mayim Tachtonim, the lower waters. And this immediately creates a terrible imbalance in existence. It's cruel. And the Mayim Tachtonim Bochim, the lower waters cry, they weep, this is how the Zohar puts it, and they say, Anan, this is Aramaic, Anan be'inan lemehevi kodam malko, we want to be before the king, we want to be in the higher position, why should we be banished to the lower realm? So there's immediately this imbalance of higher and lower, something spiritual and holy, good, and something which is low and potentially bad, so earthly. Maybe as a result of the water crying, the lower waters crying, we have a custom that when we eat bread, we dip it in salt. Because the salt is from the water, the lower water. And even if it's not sea salt, we understand the salt as having an affinity with the waters. And the table is like an altar in the temple. And the altar in the temple is the point where the physical and the spiritual join. And so therefore we have salt. There was salt on the altar as well. When something was offered at the altar, there was salt on it. And so therefore at our table there is salt. And so therefore that is an expression of trying to keep the different realms balanced together, that they shouldn't have this unhappy tension. We should be able to connect. And in fact, much of our lives is a process of connection of these two areas. Now, Adin Steinsaltz once gave an intriguing talk. It was at Bedford College, which then was a college in Regent's Park. It later on merged with Royal Holloway. And my wife was lecturing in that college at the time. And Adin came and gave a talk on the concept of the feminine. Now, of course, in the story of the creation of Adam and Eve, we have also the idea of division, particularly the way that Rashi looks at the story of the creation of woman, that it's not that she was taken, she was fashioned out of a rib, which is the normal way that people think about it. The word tzela is translated as rib. And so one can understand taking a rib and somehow carving the rib or molding it in some way so that it's a woman. But no, tzela, Rashi says, is a side. You have Adam and Eve, this is how Rashi puts it, origin from the Talmud. Adam and Eve are originally created as one being, which is male on one side and female on the other. And Adam and Eve are together. And then this is divided in two, and so you then have Adam and Eve as two separate people who then come together again in union. So there is this process of division. That's what Alan Steinsaltz was focusing on. He was comparing the division between the two halves of Adam so as to become Adam and Eve as two separate people. And that division was the beginning of a creative and generative force which wouldn't be there if they were just one being together. So he's referring back to this process of creation whereby dividing the water in this painful way to a certain extent, so that one part is now heaven and spiritual and the other part is earth and earthly, that through that comes a creative dynamic, which is in fact what we are living in. That's the process which we're living in. Okay, so we now have verse 7. Vayas Elokim et hachakia, and God made the firmament. Vayavdel ben hamayim Hashem mitachat lachakia, and he separated between the water which is below the firmament, uvein hamayim Hashem ma'al lachakia, and between the water which is above the firmament, vayihichein, and it was so. Vayikcha Elokim lachakia shamayim, and God called the firmament heaven. Vayihi erev, vayihi boker, and it was evening, and it was morning, Yom Sheni, the second day. So there we have this division which takes place on the second day. On the first day, as it says over here, light was created, and this expresses the attribute of kindness, chesed. On the second day, the firmament was created, and this expresses the second attribute, severity, gvura. Now, it is this concept of gvura that we want to try to understand a little bit more. Because on the one hand, gvura is a very negative idea. And it immediately causes this hierarchical imbalance in existence. And the rest of life is a process of trying to dissolve this division. Before the Torah was given, there was a spiritual realm of Shemayim and there was the earthly realm of people. Hashamayim Shemayim Lashem, the heavens are the heavens for God. Vaha'aretz natam nivnei Adam, and the earth was given to human beings. That is the typical pre-Sinai way of understanding the nature of existence. Comes Mount Sinai. Well, the Midrash, in Midrash Rabbah, gives a, and it also in Midrash Tanchuma, it gives a parable to explain this. It says there was a certain king, and he had the people who lived in Syria and the people who lived in Rome. And he said the people from Rome should not go up to Syria, and the people from Syria should not go down to Rome. It's interesting that Syria is at the top and Rome is at the bottom, but that's how the Midrash puts it. Then he suddenly decided, you know what? We're going to change the rule. We're going to deconstruct the barrier. The people from Syria can go down to Rome, and the people from Rome can go up to Syria. And I will begin, and that is all a parable about Mount Sinai and the giving of the Torah on Mount Sinai, because it says, Vayered Hashem al HaSinai, God descended onto the mountain, and so there is something of the upper realm descending to meet and be part of the lower realm. And what happens with the Torah is that the mitzvot of the Torah take the most spiritual aspects that we can imagine and bond them together with the most physical aspects of our experience, so that physicality and spirituality really become one, whether it is a process of eating, like eating matzah on the Seder night, next Saturday night, coming Saturday night and Sunday night, where there is a mitzvah from the Torah to eat something. And the actual eating is itself a spiritual experience and a spiritual interaction or intimacy between husband and wife. Also, there is a spiritual process which is taking place, even though in worldly terms it can be thought of as something which is part of worldliness and earthly pleasure. It's also part of something which is spiritually significant on the highest level and sacred. And so the process of being a human being is one of balancing and joining the spiritual and the physical. So therefore, we can look at this making of the rakia as setting the tension, which is then going to be resolved through the giving of the Torah and us keeping the Torah, and ultimately the coming of Messiah, of Mashiach, when the whole tension is resolved and somehow worldliness, physicality and earthly materiality become the expression of spirituality, of holiness and godliness, and therefore there is no crime and there is no war, there is peace and goodness, because suddenly everything fits together as a communion with the infinite. Now, there are many aspects of Jewish teaching which express precisely this process of the midat ha-gvura, the quality of severity, the quality of division, the quality of reaching upwards away from the world. You see, chesed reaches downwards towards the world, like Abraham. Abraham represents midat ha-chesed. How do we see his chesed? He reached down towards the world. He saw the people of Sodom who were so evil and bad in different ways. He pleaded for them. His instinct was to look for that thing which is low and which is bad and to try to help it in some way, to give to it. So what could he give the people of Sodom? He could pray on their behalf, and that's what he did. In the end, the prayer was not effective, because the people of Sodom were destroyed, and but that was what he was trying to do. So that idea of kindness, or as we see him at a certain point in the Torah, running to help guests have come to his home, he wants to help these guests in his home. That's the midat ha-chesed, the wish to welcome the other. Because a guest starts off as a stranger. And how do we relate to a stranger? The stranger is someone outside. And then comes the idea of welcoming the guest and inviting the stranger in. Okay, so I think that we have reached the point where we can now join with the Pesach Seder, and I'm going to give out Haggadot, and we will invite guests into our Seder. So these are very simple Haggadot. Chesed is, in human terms, about giving, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's giving on many different levels. Mm. And one way of giving is inviting in. Now, if we look at the Haggadah, if we begin page 16, mm. We can see there the siman, the order of the Pesach Seder. Mm-hmm. And there it speaks about Kadesh Urechatz, that we wash the hands, we make Kiddush, and then we wash the hands. But in fact, when we move on a little bit, we see there is Kiddush, and then on page 20, Kaddish, no, there are four things. Kaddish, Urechatz, Kapas, Yachatz. Right, those are the four things that come first. Making Kiddush, washing the hands, eating the Kapas, which is something dipped in salt water, and then Yachatz, breaking the middle matzah. And then comes the point where we invite people in to our home. However, before that point is Yachatz. And so I'd like to speak about that for a moment. So we have, you see at the beginning of the page 16, we have the Kiddush. And this year we will be making Havdalah in the Kiddush as well, because it'll be on Saturday night. And that's also an interesting thing. This idea of Hamavdil, separating between the sacred and the profane. Let's just look at those words.
And then it's immediately sacred again.
Yes, that's
so
right.
You don't really separate you for instant, isn't it?
Well, that's the...
Because it's hard.
Let's look at the text. It's at the bottom of page 18. Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaOlam Borem Ore HaEsh. One looks at the flames of the candles. And there is this blessing on the creating the lights of the fire. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who makes a distinction between sacred and profane, between light and darkness, between Israel and the nations, between the seventh day, Shabbat, and the six work days. You have made a distinction between the holiness of the Shabbat and the holiness of the festival, And you have sanctified the seventh day above the six work days. Even on a festival which is Shabbat is different to a festival which is not Shabbat. You have set apart and made holy your people Israel with your holiness. Blessed are you, Lord, who makes a distinction between holy and holy. So there we are in a realm of holiness, and there's a distinction between holy and holy. So there we are. We're moving from Shabbat to the festival of Pesach, and there is that distinction there. Now that's also a variety of this kind of distinction. Because we could imagine existence is just being, everything is holy. It's all holy. There's no difference between one thing and another. I remember this was a theme of a film that Allen Ginsberg made. I can't remember the name. Maybe my
poet.
Yes, yes. He made a film, and one of the theme was that everything is holy. You know, so there you're living in this. Continue.
I know some of his other poetry I wouldn't call exactly holy, but
well, Kaddish depends how you look. So that's the problem of antinomianism. Once you say that everything is holy, then you can sanctify anything at all, and it's also holy. And so it might be something which is actually gross or repellent in normal ways of looking, but suddenly looking at it in such a way that everything is holy, so there's nothing wrong, it's also holy. So that's one of the great moral dilemmas in the history of religion. That if religion is a very dry and cut and dried kind of aspect of life, you know, then you don't have this problem. You know, it's quite clear what's right and what's wrong, and you just live in that sort of way. But if you get souped up with spiritual perception and mystical intimations, then suddenly all kinds of things become possible that might not have been considered possible, and that leads to possibly dangerous avenues. And so there one has the again, the paradox. It's a little bit like breaking the vessels. When there's too much radiance, then the edges, then the vessels get broken. So we need the vessels in order to have a reliable relationship with other people. As Descartes put it, when he began his quest, he said that he is going to doubt everything. Yes, he came up with the first piece of knowledge that he could focus on, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I exist. But the prologue to that is his decision, he's going to doubt everything. And then followed the very interesting phrase, apparently, that the only thing he won't interrupt will be his relationships with other people. So his wife or his mother will be, or whoever it is around him, will be able to rely on him. He's not, and even though he is doubting everything, it's a very interesting thing, because otherwise even a little bit of doubt might send a person wandering off. So it's quite an interesting approach, and the Jewish philosopher Lev Shestov focuses on this. He was a 20th century existentialist Russian philosopher who focuses on that idea that even though you were going to doubt everything, he lived in White Russia and then left White Russia in the time of the revolution, and he went to live in Paris. And he visited Israel, a very, very interesting figure. So Lev Shestov, one of his books in English is called All Things Are Possible. So Lev Shestov, he spoke about this idea of doubting everything, but at the same time maintaining relationships with other people. You know, that's in a wholesome way, which is a very interesting principle of Ahavat Yisrael, that you have to be able to have a balance, and you can explore, but you know that there are rules to that exploration, and that really is what Jewish mystical teaching is about. Yes, there are infinite realms of exploration and of thought, but these do have a focus which is constructive and which ultimately is building life, rather than having, God forbid, a destructive possibility. Okay, so having spoken about this concept of separation, we then wash our hands, which is interesting. There you have the whole imagery again. Now we have water, which is flowing, this water of holiness, flowing onto our hands, the hands representing the part of us which tangles with the world. So it's the hands which represent the most material part of the person, whatever variety of materiality we are looking at or feeling. And so now we're pouring water onto our hands. This is often left out in many sederim. The person making the seder, someone brings to him a bowl with water and they pour water on his hands and no one else bothers. But it's actually a nice thing if one can manage to organize it, that one washes one's hands. In fact, the Lubavitcher Rebbe didn't have someone pour water on his hands. He got up and went to the sink and washed his hands.
And then everybody followed. That's
much better. It's also, what is your concept of freedom? The idea is that at the Pesach Seder we're expressing our freedom. Is the concept of freedom the idea that other people do things for you? Or is it that you're able to do things for yourself? So the idea of being able, with the help of God, you're able to get up and go to the sink and wash your hands, that is a deeper expression of freedom than having someone coming over and washing their hands for you. So whether that's the reason why he did it, I'm not sure, but that's how I would think of it. Then we say tarpas, which is the idea of taking something and dipping it in salt water and making a blessing, which is, according to the Talmud, that's in order to excite the interest of the children. And then we have yachatz. One might be in a big seder, where the only person who's got three matzot in front of him is the person running the seder. So it's worth somehow trying to be conscious of what is happening, even if it's very, far off down the table. Chassidim tend to give a k'ara, three matzahs, and the things on top of the matzot, to every male. Why every male, not every female? All right. but every male, so every male guest, and every little boy, they've all got the three matzot there, and so it's a much more prominent feature, whatever.
In a family setting as
well.
Oh
yes, absolutely, yes.
Right.
Yes, the same way that Hasidim will usually have every boy, every male and every boy will make kiddush themselves. So each person has, this empowerment, if you like. And interestingly, on Pesach, every woman also has to make kiddush. We make kiddush together, basically, and we all drink the wine. Unlike normally, the person making kiddush drinks the wine, and then he gives a little sip to everyone. Mm-hmm. But on the Seder night, whether or not everyone makes kiddush, but everyone has to actually drink the whole or most of the goblet of wine. It's not enough just to have a little sip, like on Shabbat. On Shabbat, a little sip's enough, but on Pesach, we have to drink the whole glass, or most of the glass. And so that is for everyone, male or female. So then we come to these three matzot. Now we have three matzot, which represent Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov. So
so the middle is Yitzchak.
That's right. Whichever way you look at it, the middle one is Yitzchak. Avraham is the attribute of kindness. Yitzchak is the attribute of severity, and Yaakov is the attribute of mercy. That's the third one. So the middle matzah, whether you're counting from above downwards or from below upwards, the middle matzah is Yitzchak. Yitzchak is the attribute of severity. Now, another way of thinking of the three matzah is Kohen Levi Yisrael, the priest, the Levite, and the regular Jew. There again, the priest represents the attribute of Chesed, Levi represents the attribute of severity, and Yisrael is Yaakov, which is the attribute of Rachamim, of mercy. So there again, whichever way you look, the middle matzah represents the Levi. Incidentally, Kohen Levi Yisrael is Kaf Lamed Yud, is Keli, is a vessel. We're trying to make a vessel for the spirituality of the experience of the Seder night. And so the whole process is one of somehow absorbing something very intense and bringing it into our vessel. However, what is the effect of that? Kohen Levi Yisrael is one way. Let's just look at this for a second. Kohen Levi. Israel. I hope the people can see that. So Kof Lamad Yud is Keli, making the vessel. But if we look at it the other way round, Yud Lamad Chaf. What's that?
Yelech.
Yelech. Movement. When a person becomes a vessel to radiance, they are able to move. The whole process of life is, the whole process or the quest of spiritual life is to be able to move, not to be static, to be able to grow. And so by absorbing this radiance, then one is able to, in the right way, in a balanced way, one is then able to move, and there is a dynamic within the person. Pesach should be an experience, a Seder night. And the whole process of Pesach should be something which changes us, so that we are then on a new level in some way. In some sense, every day should be a process which we go through and we expand and we grow and we move. Certainly when we come to significant events like the Seder. Now then, we take the middle matzah, which represents the power of Gvura, and we break it. Yachatz. Let's see what it says over here in English. Take the middle matzah and break it in two, one piece larger than the other. The larger piece is set aside to serve as afikomen, which we're going to eat at the very end of the meal. It's wrapped up and hidden away. Some people have the custom that children try to steal it and then ransom it. Many bicycles change hands at this point, eventually. And the smaller piece is put back between the two matzot. Now, there is a Chabad custom, which is that the larger piece which is set aside to serve as the afikomen is itself broken. And it's broken into five pieces. So therefore, we've got a large matzah. I'm imagining a round matzah. Okay, we break it in half, less unequal halves. this smaller part is going to remain, and it's going to be the matzah which is there in the dish with three matzahs. That's going to be the middle matzah which is broken, and that is going to be showing. A lot of the time during the Seder, one allows this broken matzah to be visible, and the word lechem oni, the bread of poverty, bread of affliction. So the idea of bread of affliction is that it's broken, it's not whole. But also lechem oni means that it's the bread that we say a lot of things about, as we do on the Seder night. So that's one aspect of the, that's the smaller part of the matzah. And then this larger part, which is going to become the afikomen, we break that somehow into five pieces. 1, 2, 3, 4, and another one is 5. So there we have 5 pieces of matzah. Now, why do we break it? This is a Kabbalistic custom, to break the afikomen into 5 and then to wrap it up and put it away. Why is it broken into 5? Now, 5 is the letter He. 5 is the number He. And 5 is the process, because He, Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, He, right? Now, He is the basic substance of speech, except that it's broken into 5 different types of consonant, melody, sound, song. Just a pure sound is transformed into speech by being broken in various ways, by being interrupted. Speech, the difference between just someone singing a single note or a melody and speech is the way that the sound is interrupted. And the names of the different types of consonant. You see, consonants differ from each other. Each consonant is different. But there are 5 groups of consonants. And it's interesting that the ancient Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Creation, which is attributed to Avraham Avinu, to Abraham, and it's a book about the nature of existence, the spiritual nature of existence, that book speaks about 5 types of consonant. And if we were studying linguistics in London University, we would also learn about the same 5 types of consonant. That's another one of these, you know, scientific and Kabbalistic correspondences. So we call them in English sibilants, fricatives, dentals, labials, gutturals. Mm-hmm. Right? Now those 5, the only thing that's outside those 5 is the click that the Khoza have, and I can't pronounce it. Can anyone?
Iklicha.
Yeah, thank you very much.
The Africa.
That's it. So that click somehow, you know, I don't quite know whether, you know, where it would be classed, but it's but other languages all use varieties of these 5 consonants. And that is how everything is fitted together as language. Language creates existence. So therefore, what we have here is the process of severity. We have the middle matzah. We even have the idea of breaking and dividing, which is here an ambiguous concept, because it's 2 ideas. On the one hand, it's breaking and dividing the way that the attribute of severity is itself something dividing and making a hierarchy. And on the other hand, we are breaking and dividing the attribute of severity so that we are sweetening the attribute of severity. We are transforming the attribute of severity. It's one action which has 2 meanings. We're breaking this larger part into 5 pieces. in the same way that sound is broken into five different types of consonant, the sound of godliness, the sound of the melody which precedes existence, is transformed into the words of creation which make the world that we're living in, and we are imitating that. And at the same time, through the fact that we are doing that, we are sweetening the attribute of Gvura, so that instead of it being severity, it becomes Chesed. And that's how it becomes Afikoman. Now, Afikoman in Aramaic, Afiku means bring out. Man is like manna. Bring out something sweet. Afikuman. So afikomen means dessert. Afikomen, the Greek word, or the Greek term, which the way the sages use it, it means dessert. It means something at the end of the meal. But so what do we have at the end of a meal? Something sweet, usually. Afikuman means bringing out something sweet, like manna, something positive, something wholesome. We are changing the attribute of severity into something which is sweet. And so this process of taking a border which is there and recognizing the existence of the border, and then transforming the border so that we are able to open it up, that is a key moment, I believe, in what the Seder is about and what life is about. Let's go on to the next passage where we say Magid Helach Mo'anya. Would you like to read this, Michael? This is the bread of affliction. Here. It's on page 21. 21. Well, it's 20 in Hebrew, 21 in English.
Oh, in English, all right.
Yeah, just read the English. This Magid, this is the bread of affliction.
This is the bread of affliction that our fathers ate in the land of Egypt. Whoever is hungry, let him come and eat. Whoever is in need, let him come and conduct the Seder of Pesach. This year we are here, next year in the land of Israel. This year we are slaves, next year we will be free people.
Now there's actually reams of commentary on every little bit of the Seder. I'd like to just focus on one aspect here. The idea of hospitality. The Seder night is traditionally, in temple times, incidentally, it didn't work like this, because in temple times you were supposed to get organized before you slaughter the Paschal Lamb, exactly who was going to be partaking of it. So you had to work out which cousin is coming to your Seder and which is, you know, or whether they're going to your sister's Seder. So everyone, you did actually work out where everyone was going to be. But since the destruction of the temple, we're in a more deconstructed mode. And it's interesting that in some ways there are sometimes more profound elements which are visible. So one of the things is the way in which it's traditional in a traditional community to want to have guests for the Seder night and to try to get to acquire guests. So there are many synagogues where the shamash will, you know, look around and see who is there who might possibly not have a Seder to go to, and he go up and ask, you know, what would you like to be invited to a Seder? And, you know, then you have the jostling of all the people who have the big Sedarim who want to have another person and another person. So that sense of welcoming guests. And that is the concept of Chesed. That is Abraham. That is the idea of that one's own restricted realm, which is our home. A home is something very beautiful. And at the same time, it is something very specific with a wall around it, and we're inside the home, and the other person, the other, is outside. And the ability to make room for the other is a key step in this process of sweetening the concept of Gvura. You see, if we didn't have Gvura at all, without offense to certain customs of certain peoples, someone wrote a book about China, where she describes, it's about the women of China, very interesting work, where she describes that there is a region of China which is so poor that the men cannot afford to have one wife each. So they have a group of four men or five men who share a wife. Right? She said it was the most, and this is totally against the Maoist Chinese ethos, which remains part of Chinese thinking, even in a certain level of thought. People can be arrested in modern China for committing adultery, or for being immodestly dressed in the street. They can be arrested. So the cadres, the people who are, you know, from the central government, who are in charge of seeing that society runs properly, well, they say that's their tradition. So their tradition is one in which they do not have this barrier, who is my wife and who is someone else's wife. It's just not there, and it's... She describes it as a very, very, very unhappy state of being. But there we have a lack of structure.
Sorry, I've been, got a bad headache.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I'm gonna leave.
Okay, be well. So there we have a lack of structure, which can mean that there is no interrelate, that we don't have the... we lose something if we don't have that quality of gvura, but at the same time the sense of gvura has to be sweetened. So we have my home, your home, your home, and at the same time we also have to be able to have the door which is open and which where guests are able to enter. Now that is at this part of the Seder. We then go through the Seder and we tell about the idea of the we tell about the idea of we have the child asks the four questions, and we begin to report that having drunk one glass, we then pour another glass, and at this point the child asks his four questions, or everyone asks the four questions, and then we give the answer, Avadim Hayinu, we were slaves. Now the four sons are the wise son, the wicked son, the simple son, and the son who doesn't know how to ask, right? The four children. The first cup is like Kiddush. So that's like, is Kiddush, is like the wise son. The second cup that we fill just before the Manishtana, that is like the wicked son. And the rest of the Seder, basically, up to just before the meal, is all said on that second cup. One can say that what one is trying to do is transform the wicked son. The whole concept of the Seder is in order to take the son who has questions, who rejects it, for whom it doesn't mean anything, and to try and make it meaningful for him. So that is the second cup at the Seder night. There again, if you say that the wise son is the attribute of Chesed and the wicked son is the attribute of Gvura, we're trying to transform that negative quality into something positive. With the wine itself, we have a goblet of wine, and there is a certain stage when we repeat, we speak about the 10 plagues. And we pour out the 10 drops of wine corresponding to the 10 plagues. And in fact, there are several, a few, if we look at page 32 and 33. So we have here the 10 plagues. And then after the 10 plagues, it says, Rabbi Yehuda haya noten bahem simanim. Rabbi Judah would put a siman for the 10 plagues, and it's these three groups of letters, Datsach, Adash, Ba'achav, which are simply the initial letters of each of the 10 plagues. But we also have the custom to pour out a drop there as well. So there's 13 drops altogether are poured out. Now what happens after pouring out those drops? So you have a half filled glass of wine. The custom is to fill that now, so that you end up again with a full glass. And when we come a few pages later, at the end of half Hallel, which is going to be on page 40, that we then say it, we've said Hallel, and we say Baruch Atah Hashem Ga'al Yisrael, blessed are you God who redeems Israel, we then say Bore Pri Agafen, and we drink the second glass. Now something has taken place during this process of having the second glass there, pouring out the wine and adding more wine, and then finally saying a blessing on it and drinking it. Because wine itself has this ambiguity. Wine is, on the one hand, yayin hamashaker, the wine which makes one drunk. Lot got drunk and as a result had intercourse with his two daughters. The wine which makes one drunk is something which has sinister possibility. On the other hand, there is yayin hamasameach, the wine which makes one joyful. So we're dealing here, it's like playing with fire. Fire is something which is warm and which brings radiance and comfort and coziness into a person's life. And it's also something negative which can cause terrible danger, God forbid. So wine is the same thing. And midat ha-gvura is also something which can be negative or which ultimately can give a balance in a person's life. So here we are transforming this. We're transforming the wine as well, so that the negative quality of the wine is being transformed into something positive. So instead of it being the yayin hamashaker, the wine which makes one drunk, it becomes the wine which makes one rejoice. And that also, yayin, yud, yud, and nun, is 10 and 10 and 50, which is the same numerical value, it comes to 70 altogether. That is the same as sod, samach 60 and 6 and dalet, samach vav dalet. Nichnas yayin yatsa sod, when the wine enters, the secret comes out. So wine gives access to something very spiritual, but it has to be in the right way, otherwise it has this antinomian dimension, which is dangerous. Now, we then have the matzah and the maror, the bitter herbs. The bitter herbs, eating the bitter herbs with a blessing and the particular kind of joyfulness that there is as a Seder night, eating the bitter herbs, means that we are taking this attribute of severity which normally causes pain and suffering, and we are somehow diffusing it. And we are saying not that it's bitter and bad, it's bitter and good. And we somehow, it's a complete reversal. So we're on a kind of a border of ambiguities here, and we're taking something which is negative and making it into something positive. Then after the maror, we have maror dipped in charoset, which is obviously from the positive side of the spectrum. We then have, we finally have the afikomen, and we bench. We have the afikomen, we have this matzah which was broken up, and we eat this at the end of the meal, and it's the last thing that we eat. And then we say birkat hamazon, and we have another glass of wine at the end of grace after meals, birkat hamazon, that's on page 48, 49. And then, on page 50, we pour out a new glass, the fourth cup is poured, and it's at this moment that we pour out the glass for Elijah the prophet. So that's page 50 and 51. And then the door is opened.
Now this is really a key point in the Sefer. This is a key point in the Sefer. Because in terms of the whole structure of existence that we saw from the Olam HaTohu, the world of chaos, and then the reconstruction, the world of Tikkun, and the quality of radiance of Yehi Or, which is Chesed, and then Yehi Rakia, which is Gvura. That Gvura means that there are many, many different levels, and the idea of spirituality is to ascend in some way to a higher level of the holy, and somehow that is a very difficult process. And the Kabbalists, particularly the Merkava mystics, they talk of doorways, gateways between these different levels, and that's one of the reasons why many Kabbalistic books are written in terms of sha'arim, gateways. Gate of Ahava, gate of this, gate of that. There are other books as well of the early teachers, but this idea of gates. And what is happening when we open the door here is that all the doors, there's a tradition that at that moment all the doors are open, all spiritual doors as well. So this is really a moment of meeting, of connection between the spiritual and the physical. So we had that division between the Shemayim, the heavens, and the earth, with gateways and different levels and gates which are closed, and the Merkava mystics which speak about special divine names which were needed in order to open those doors. At this moment, for every Jewish family at the Seder night, all the doors are open. And it's at that moment that one is able to have a special, intimate connection with the divine. It's a moment of prayer for something that one wants. And that is really an important climax in the Seder. And we then go on and finish Hallel, and we finally drink the fourth glass after a kind of an ecstatic process of Tfilah, which it moves into the mode of the Shabbat prayers, and really it shows us what the Shabbat prayers are supposed to be. Nishmat Kol Chai, the soul of every living thing should praise you.
Beautiful.
It's a really ecstatic mode of the Seder, and then we conclude that and drink the wine, and we say L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim, next year in Yerushalayim. And that moment of next year in Yerushalayim, that is really where we are trying to dissolve the ultimate division, the division of exile, so that indeed there should be a oneness. And the oneness is not only oneness for the Jewish people as a whole, it's a oneness for each person, and it's a oneness for all humanity. So that's what we're trying to achieve. Okay.
Beautiful.
That's right.
Let's try again.
Is your mom alive? I don't know, he started to feel ill, but he'd be